Today we are joined by Enoch Sears from the Business of Architecture and the Business of Architecture podcast, and I'm sure many other entrepreneurial endeavors. Enoch, welcome to
Architecture. Thanks. Evan and Cormac, good to be here with y'all and your audience as well.
I think it's the first time you've been on our show. You've had us on your show a couple of times in the past. It was a distant past, though, but that just shows the longevity of both of our podcasts. We were talking a little bit before the show. We've both been doing it for over 10 years now. So Business of Architecture podcast, for those if they haven't heard of it, is also has the longevity of just a few podcasts in the architectural realm out there. So I'm really excited to have you on the show. It's been a long time coming.
Absolutely. So thanks for showing up. It's good to be here, guys. Good to be here.
So are we like the grandfathers of architectural podcasting?
I think we.
If you're watching on YouTube, you can see all the gray hair.
Right? Definitely. Yeah. Who here is a grandfather, by the way?
Oh, not yet.
See, not yet.
We're all looking at each other.
Not yet. Let's not call that one quite yet. Well, the longest running podcasts by independent producers like ourselves, they all started around the same time. It was that, like, 2012. You guys started. Mark started his podcast. I started, and it was like, but there was just this boom. It's almost like cosmic consciousness was like, it's time to start some architecture podcasts.
It was time to let some of this stuff out into the internet, right? It was like, I think you're right.
You know, because if you think about it, it was also the time when we were meeting each other digitally through Twitter, and we all had conversations kind of going back and forth with each other. Our digital friendship, let's just call it that, our friendships were growing. And everybody, I don't think anybody ever like said, hey, Enoch, are you going to do a podcast? Evan and I are going to do a podcast. Mark's going to do a podcast. It was just, we had something to say. There was nobody saying it. So why not?
Absolutely. And keeping them consistent is a challenge. I don't know if I would have started the Business Architecture podcast if it wouldn't have been for Osha Wilson. So she was one of the people who was part of that early of blogosphere in architecture as well. And I had wanted to start a podcast for a while, but I kept on putting it off, like so many good projects that maybe you gentlemen can identify with. It's the Someday Project. Oh, that'd be really cool if I did that. But I was talking to her maybe via email or something. I said, you know what? I'm starting a podcast and I really want to have you as the first guest. And she's like, well, great. When do you want to do it? And I said, well, when would you like to? She's all, how about 3 weeks from now? I'm like, oh, shit, 3 weeks. I got to buy a microphone. Yeah. I better figure out how to upload a podcast.
Yeah.
And then once I'd done that.
So I have to figure this out now.
Exactly. It was like, the hat over the wall moment. Like, okay, we have this on the calendar. And then when I did the first one, I'm like, well, shoot, I better find a second one. Who's going to be my second guest? And here we are 10 years later. So it's been good. It's been fun to be a voice in the industry, in the profession, talking about when we were younger architects back in the day. I know there wasn't, it does come down to friendships. I think you said, Cormac, it was like the first time we were reaching out and discovering the voice within the profession. Mm-hmm. You know, Twitter was facilitating that. And I do remember there was a lot of Twitter back and forth. I had my list of people where we'd all talk back and forth. And
the Twitter text.
The Twitter. Yeah. And here we go. X.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. Enoch, have you always had guests? Have you ever done kind of solo shows or a bit with you? And how do you even describe Ryan? Is he your partner in podcasting?
Yeah, he's a business partner, and he's also an excellent business consultant, coach, leadership and transformational coach. So he leads a lot of the programs that we have within Business of Architecture that we've developed over the past 10 years. He does a lot of one-to-one coaching and consulting. So yeah, not only is he the host of the podcast, but also, and that relationship, again, started online. He reached out to me, I think back in 2018, and he just wanted to start contributing to the podcast. He was hungry for this kind of information, resonating with it, had been feeling restless in his own architectural journey, and realized that he was looking for something more, didn't know what it was. So he reached out and I said, hey, Enoch, could I contribute to the podcast? And I said, yeah, why don't you try interviewing some people there locally. London's an epicenter for architecture, and there's a lot of people you could talk to. So we started doing that, and that relationship built to where I invited him to. We started creating some courses together, and now he's full-time on the team here at Business of Architecture, and we lock arm in arm. So to answer the question about do we do guest podcasts or solo, in the guest. It was always guest. I've always found it personally kind of challenging to do a solo podcast because it's just me. It's just a monologue. I really like interviewing people. But with Ryan now, it's very nice because Ryan can get on there and Ryan and I will banter back and forth. So a lot of the past 50 episodes or so, half of them have been Ryan and I just discussing some of the challenges of, you know, what it's really like to run an architectural practice, what some of the challenges are that we're seeing that small firm owners are facing, and some of the forming teams, some of the missed dynamics in terms of culture and leading teams. So we're sprinkling more of those in.
So when you originally started out, did you notice that as lacking out there on the internet, those kinds of topics, especially with the audience that you're now speaking to? Did you identify that audience back then of smaller to medium-sized firms? I mean, I'm really curious if this just grew organically out of a need that you saw that did not exist in the landscape of media in architecture.
Yeah, I it's funny, like when we talk about business, we always, at least even when we teach and you read books about it, it's all about visioning and you craft your 5-year, 10-year vision and then you work backwards, the yearly goals and your benchmarks and you're tracking your numbers and you're out to get where I'm at. I never would have invented this. It was all organic. And the whole reason I started the podcast was I was researching my own information, trying to figure out what I didn't know about the business side of architecture, because there wasn't a whole lot of information out there. It was just very dense information. There was the Architect's Handbook of Professional Practice, which is like 3 inches thick, and it has a lot of great articles in it, but they're all very academic. And how do you then condense that information? And like, freak, I'm supposed to run a small architectural practice. Like, what part of this is actually applicable to what I do? And as I started to reach out to and interview other people on the podcast with no intentions of ever consulting, with no intentions of ever creating any sort of coursework or training around this, the appetite was really, I could tell it was there, because people came to me and wanted advice and about what I was learning, particularly on the marketing side, on the business development side of how to get the right projects and how to win work. And as I would interview architects, I discovered that while even though on the outside, I'm speaking about small firms, even on the outside, while they would be very successful on the outside, you would talk to them and you'd find out that they were working long hours, or that they weren't making as much money as you thought they were, or they weren't being able to hire the team members. And so they'd have someone who maybe left the practice, and then now they're in a lurch, and now they're in all hands on deck. And they were just like, how long has this been going on like this? So like, just the way it is, it's been 20 years like this. And I was just thinking, there has to be a better way.
I mean, if you think about it, on your journey of kind of like discovery of what don't I know about business and what can I learn? I'm not learning it from probably the places that you worked at. Because we know that, especially if you're in a corporate environment or something, it's rare that they're going to be sharing business practices with younger staff and stuff like that. And then as you started to interview them, it's interesting because, and this is what I've known from listening to Business of Architecture, is that you're starting to identify, it's just like, oh, this is a voice that needs to be heard. Let's start sharing them. Let's start this knowledge share that otherwise doesn't really exist. And you're right. It's basically, you know, like most of the time, I would say definitely in my career, I learned from experience. I learned from listening, picking people's brains, doing it, possibly succeeding, sometimes failing, and in learning from that. And what's interesting is the stories that you share are stories of those very things that people are like, oh, and just remember, if you do this, then this might happen kind of thing. And people are like, I don't want that to happen to me. So I'm going to learn to avoid that, you know?
I think also in large firms, Cormac, like you're in my experience, is very different from Enoch's audience, right? Because you're, I think, okay, so in a firm, there is a CFO who has a degree in finance, right? There's an HR director, and there are the marketing department, and there's all these really specialy roles. In small firms, you're doing all that stuff. And the education that we get does not train us in business. Enoch, I would love to hear from you. Like, this is the world you live in, is you have architects coming to you where everything is right on the main video on your YouTube page. And the guy is at one of your retreats, and he says, everything's right in between my two ears. The whole system is right there. And that's where, because it's like this thing just builds up over time, and you're just doing one project to the next, and then you got a couple clients, and now you might have to hire somebody. And it just slowly builds until it's, holy crap, what's actually, how do I do all this? And it's like almost like they don't even know how they found themselves there. And there's no training to back it up when we're in school.
Yeah, absolutely. One of the challenges for me starting out, and I had worked in a large firm at one time, and then I've worked in small firms, but one of the challenges is working in a small firm was I didn't even know what business meant. If that, as strange as that sounds, like I knew business was just this ephemeral thing. Mm-hmm. And I knew there were CFOs, I knew there were HR people, but what the heck do they actually do? And how does that relate to a small practice? And so we call it the business of architecture. We talk about business a lot, but like I'm sure that probably doesn't have a lot of meaning to architects. When they hear business, at least I did previous to this, business to me was like, well, what does that mean? I collect invoices. Is that like what? Are you an LLC or are you a corporation? I mean, how you file your taxes? What does business actually mean?
People are like, no, thank you. All I want to do is just do buildings.
Exactly. Yeah. Please. Yeah. Keep me far
away. Yeah. It's like, well, you need to tie the strings between getting the projects and doing the projects.
So it's interesting to me, Enoch, to hear that the podcast is where you started, and then through the feedback you're getting and people like raising their hands and saying, I want to hear more about that, this is where the business that I assume makes up more of the business now is really on that side of it, where you're coaching. You've got systems you can share across firms, lessons learned, all this kind of stuff. I would love to hear kind of more about that side of it because, I mean, number one, it is interesting that it grew out of this, just you putting yourself out there. But then how did you actually gain the skills to do that, and how have you grown that over time?
Yeah, thanks for asking. Again, it was organic. I wouldn't have ever, so I consider the space I exist in right now, I don't practice architecture full-time or even part-time. I still have my license, but I don't practice architecture. We consult and we help small architectural practice owners just be able to implement a simple system so that they can get back to doing more what they love, the architecture, and not having to be so stressed out. So they can make more money, they can start taking vacations, get more freedom and flexibility, which is what they want. I don't have an MBA. As a matter of fact, if I did go to MBA business school, probably 80% of it would be irrelevant to what it takes to really run a small practice. They're talking about in MBA programs, logistics and global trends and macroeconomic trends and currency exchange and arbitrage and high level leadership skills and things like that. What I discovered about really the business of architecture is that if we were going to summarize business would just be, it's the ability to make the money. That's it. It's just the ability to make enough money to do your craft. And, you know, the more money you have, the more agency you have to be able to do your craft. It doesn't necessarily mean that your architecture is going to be better or you're going to get better projects, but let's face it, the more money you have, it's going to allow you then to pursue more with more freedom of what you want to pursue.
Makes sense, yeah. So how much of that really is based around having systems in place so that that side of the business can run itself almost? Because I would assume that a lot of the people that you're working with want to stay small on purpose because then they have the agency that you were talking about earlier.
Yeah. Well, so it's been interesting. I mean, this whole journey has been fascinating for me because what I've noticed is that as architects in architecture, there's reluctance to grow. So there's a fear of growth because I've heard a lot of times, I've seen it myself, where firms will grow, people will grow to 10, 11, 12 people, and they're like, oh. Then I went back to 4 or 5 because it was just too much, right? And that has, as we've looked more into it, that has more to do with the leadership style and the lack of systems of a practice than it does the nature of architecture. So in other words, yeah, if you're trying to do everything yourself, if you're still trying to have 12, 11 people report to you, that's a recipe for losing a lot of hair, putting out a lot of fires, and just feeling completely stressed out of your mind. And so that's where, yes, systems. We provide architecture firm owners with systems. So the very first program I did, one of the first programs that we offered was, hey, here's a little bundle of systems, invoicing systems, financial systems, systems for hiring if you need them, systems for marketing your practice. And it was a short course program that we would have people go through, and they'd set up these systems. And they got great results. They loved it. They were able to put a lot of these things that they weren't doing more on autopilot, so they had more time. But what I began to discover was that there was still something missing. So there was still something missing. They were still feeling overwhelmed. They were still feeling some of the feast or famine cycle of architecture. And what I realized that it wasn't just the systems and processes. Those were essential. It was also had to do with the mindsets and the way of thinking of the architects. So for instance, prioritizing business development. This is thing number one. And we, in our program, we call it Rainmaker. We have this program called Rainmaker. And the whole idea of the Rainmaker program is like, you need to see yourself as a rainmaker. It's actually an identity shift where you actually, a little switch goes off in your head and you're no longer just the architect. You're like, I am the rainmaking savage. I'm the one who's going to go out there and hell or high water, I'm bringing in the money. I'm bringing in the projects.
So let's expand that a little bit, because a lot of times, and I know this from experience, both as a former small business owner that went back to the big practices, but also just I have friends who have either stayed small or they've started small and then they've grown. A lot of times the rainmakers, the ones who started this, this was their vision, this was their passion. Some of their reluctance is that, oh, but I'm not going to do architecture anymore. I'm going to have to do business development. I don't want to do business development. I want to do architecture. Yeah. And that's been the pushback. I mean, it was me and two other college buddies of mine, and we were working, and all of us wanted to do architecture. We didn't want to do business.
There's no architecture without business development.
Exactly. I already said, I said that early on. We didn't know that. Hence the reason why, I mean, you know, 2008 didn't help us, you know, the whole recession was what said, all right, you're done. You know, it's like, you guys didn't teach yourself how to survive. Well, you're not going to.
But going back to school, again, like this is not the kind of thing that we got any training in. We got trained in how to work for somebody else who already had it figured out. And there's just an assumption that you're going to go work for somebody else who already has it figured out, right? And that isn't even the case either. It's absolutely crazy.
Oh, yeah. And most of the time, the people who figured it out, they had to struggle and feast, famine, and everything else in between to get to the part where we look at them and say, oh, yeah, you got this figured out. And they're probably just, you know, the old adage of the duck on a pond, look all nice and calm up above, but they're like struggling down below.
This is the perpetual flywheel of the struggle bus, right? Because it just does keep feeding itself. I mean, Enoch, what do you think about all that?
It's so true. I had Lance Cycle on the podcast just recently, F9 Productions out of Denver, and he had posted something on, oh, can I swear on this podcast, by the way, or is this?
Too late. You already did.
I did. Yeah. You caught that. Can I, or should I refrain? Should I use
your
language?
You're perfectly fine. Yeah.
Okay, good. So he just got this great award and recognition as being a top business person in his local community. I was like, yeah, it's awesome. But he posted this thing on Facebook and had talked about that award and that recognition. He said, look, here's what it come down to. I would get up every morning, I would fucking hustle and grind. I still fucking hustle and grind. So there's an element that certainly, well, here's the thing. Like in our program, what we've seen is architects come through. Yes, there's the hustle and grind, but it depends on how much you're hustling and grinding. Because when architects come through our program, when they leave, they cannot sing our praises enough. They're saying, I didn't understand these things. It's so much less stress now. I'm making more money now. Now, I'm still working hard. And yeah, if the economy turns around, they're still going to have to face with the external circumstances of clients who maybe don't want to pay them what they want to get paid. And all that stuff doesn't go away. But sort of like that quote that says, I can't remember what it was. It wasn't that the world changed for the easier. It's just that I got more capable.
Yeah. Yeah, I think part of it is just the not knowing what you don't know. And then that is kind of a crippling weight for a lot of people because they're already doing so much. And there's this kind of, oh, what do you mean? Like I have to do all this other stuff too. And I want to go back to one of your earlier points about how, you know, there's somebody managing 10 people and they want to cut it back down to 4 because that's more manageable. I'm just curious because I saw this all the time working in an office was that as architects, and Cormac, you were just talking about this too, right? Like everybody wants to do the work. They want to drive the bus, right? And And they don't want to necessarily go off and run the business or think about strategy for the business, where the business is going to be in 5 years. And there's this kind of natural tendency to just want to stay in the creative zone or in the technical right. zone or whatever zone, the management zone of the projects and working directly with clients. And they don't want to step back and work on the practice, which then starts to get to the systemization of things, right? And or even looking outside for help with those kinds of things and not, I mean, architects, again, I think we're very guilty of always wanting to invent our own wheel when it comes to a lot of that stuff rather than get somebody else's expertise in to help us do that who's already done it. Enoch, what do you think about all that? Because that tendency to hang on to the wheel is you're going to pry this out of my cold, dead hands and I'm not going to go off and work on the practice because I'm doing what I am born to do, which is to be an architect.
Yeah, exactly. And but what ends up happening is they're not actually doing that. They're not actually getting to be the architect, or they're doing it 10 o'clock at night, or they're doing it in a rushed fashion because they don't have the time, the free time to sit back and do it. So, you know, our graduates that go through our program, once they have the basic education understanding of what it takes to run a business and this minimal systems that you want to have in place to run the business, you can run it. You don't need to be in the business all the time. You hire people that take care of it, hire an office manager, you understand. Like an architect with a team of maybe 5 to 8 people, which is probably the large majority of small practices out there. The practice owners could set up that practice to spend 50% of their time on design work if they hired the right people. Right. Yeah. And if they had the right systems.
I would say from my experience, and this was always a conversation that we had, is would I ever do it again or what would I do differently? And the thing that we always, in Evan, you just said, is like, we didn't want to let go of being the architect. You know, and the thing was, is that we, you know, didn't realize that we weren't going to be an architect if we didn't have clients, because what are you going to be practicing? Yeah. Looking for a job at 7-Eleven or something, because that's essentially like, it was just like, we never realized, it's just like, in Enoch, you said it perfectly. It's just like finding the people to complement your weaknesses with their strengths and using your strengths to complement their weaknesses. And so to be able to build a business that actually has strengths rather than just a series of single-minded vision, which is what most architects, at least I knew the friends that had started practices when we were trying to start our practice, a lot of them are now, some of them are very successful and have gone on to keep their business going or started another business after their first one failed. But it was seeing the vision that, as you're saying, is learning how to operate the business first, learning that there's more to architecture, an architecture business than just architecture in what we have in our mind of like just drawing the things, just doing the construction documents, just doing the client service. All of that is not just the business of architecture.
Yeah. Enoch, when people are coming to you, I'm curious to know like when they're coming to you, because, and I'm not talking about age, I'm talking like in their course of practicing architecture, how many are coming to you proactively to set things up right in the beginning versus quiet desperation?
That's a good question.
On their last rope, because I could see a pretty equal split potentially there. But I also tend to think that people maybe are more towards the latter. It's like, oh my gosh, like this thing's about to end. I don't want it to end. I want to do it better. Like we all want to do it right. But I'm wondering if people do come to you early and proactively, or if it's more reactive and trying to save something, or knowing that it's completely like beyond them to be able to pull this all together without help?
Great, great question. I wish I could say that 90% of the people were aspirational, that everything was firing on all cylinders and they came to us out of abundance looking to take it to the next level. That's unfortunately not the reality. And as I've become a student of human psychology, what I've realized is what really motivates us to change and to do something different is the pain. So I would say 15% of the architects who we work with, 15% come proactively. And I'm really impressed because I probably wouldn't have done it when I was their age. I'm like, damn, my hat's off to you. That's really awesome. They're starting up a firm. They're in the first couple of years. Maybe things are going well right now and they recognize they want to take advantage of the good times to be able to really solidify for the future. That's 15%. The other you know, we don't really get people. Sometimes we get people who are really on their back foot, and then that becomes a difficult challenge because they don't have money to invest in working with us. Our fees aren't super high. We're achievable for any most small practices can find a budget to get our help. You know, so it's not that. But you know, the other ones, the other, what's that, 85%? Yeah, they come to us because of the pain. They're not making enough money, or typically it's they don't even see it as enough money, but they're just finding that they're stressed out a lot. They're overwhelmed a lot. They're finding they're on their phone in the evenings. They're finding they're getting up and getting in at 7 o'clock before everyone's there. They feel like they're constantly checking emails all day and never being able to actually get down the task list that they're working on. And so what was the dream of doing good architecture, getting well compensated for it, and having some free time has become more of the dread of. And so a lot of times what we do, human beings, what we do in these situations is we delude ourselves, to be quite honest. It'll get better. And I know because I've done this in my life. Like, it'll get better. If I just keep on doing what I'm doing, eventually it'll get better. I remember this when
we
I was
are
running
optimists.
My practice. Yeah, we're inherently, there's a part of us that, we don't want to face soul crushing defeat. We don't want to face the truth that this may last for the rest of our lives.
But at the same time, like, there's this hesitancy to ask for help or to seek for professional advice or help. And I think, again, this kind of, I'm just my observation or in my opinion, the idea of us and how we get trained in school is to be totally self-sufficient. And I think that comes to the surface as a professional to feel like we are the ones who have to do the job all the way through and do all aspects of it, right? And be completely self-sufficient. I'm curious, do you see that in people who, like, is it a struggle for them to even reach out to you, or are they just really proactive about it?
Oh, yeah, and it's more of a struggle for the men. I'm not going to lie. Yeah. We look at our numbers. We have half of the people in our program are women, which I think is awesome. But if you look at that, like, that's a lot more proportionally than we have in the industry.
Right. Okay. I see where you're going.
So in my head, I've thought about this with Ryan and some of my other team members. Like, wow, we get our numbers are not reflective of the overall makeup of architecture. We get a lot more people of color, which is awesome. I love that. We get a lot more women with joining the program as well, which is great. And I'm not sure why that is psychological. I can guess. I don't really know the reason for that. But we're happy because they bring an awesome enthusiasm and energy in. One thing we do notice is a lot of times our women firm owners, they are some of our most successful firm owners are the women. They're like, you tell them to do something, they go out there and hell or high water, they're like making it happen. Mm. And so we just sit back and we're just like, bravo, bravo. But I mean, asking for help is difficult for any of us. I mean, I'm the guy who will drive around endlessly telling my wife I know where I'm going, you know, before stopping to ask the guy for directions before the GPS was around. But yeah, there certainly is that part of it. And also I think it really goes back to psychology, but great point when you were talking about architects, it's a very expansive profession. I mean, the way we're trained is to look at things very holistically and be problem solvers. And so I know coming out of architecture school, I myself thought I could do everything. I'm like, I'll do it all. I'll figure out my own legal contracts. I'm so smart. I can figure all this stuff out. And at school, interdisciplinary teams were not really, they didn't really happen.
Right.
I mean, there was Solar Decathlon was like the one thing. As I was kind of graduating, that was becoming a thing. But that was like, I was really impressed with that because with the Solar Decathlon in the school, they were encouraging, they were bringing in kids from the economics department. They were bringing in kids from the engineering department. And it was like this multidisciplinary team that was put together. So yeah, that's one thing that can definitely hold small firms back. And I really relate it back to having what I call an abundance mindset or a cost-based mindset. So allow me to explain.
Yeah.
Cost-based mindset is we're always just perceiving everything as a cost. So I view my sub-consultants as a cost. I view a business consultant or a coach as a cost. I view team members as costs. Whereas what I found is the most successful entrepreneurs, they realize that these things are investments. And they don't jump into them willy-nilly, not just going to hire a bunch of people because it's an investment, hire a bunch of business coaches because, hey, they're investments. No, they do the proper due diligence to make sure they're entering in a relationship that's valuable, but they go into that, they do invest. So they invest in coaches, they invest in mentors, they invest in team members, and they see it as an investment. So that was, if there's one critical change that I would say to firm owners that like can really prepare your success, is like, just start looking at things from an investment standpoint. And then you won't be coming to me telling me, Enoch, I've just woken up and realized that I've hired an inexperienced team because they were inexpensive. And now I'm stuck because I'm the one doing a lot, the lion's share of the work, and I have less time than I did before. And I've created basically an architectural kindergarten now, where I'm the headmaster and I'm having to go around and help all these kids, as opposed to, and the reason I did have a firm owner say this to me, as a matter of fact, great firm owner, you'd probably know who he was. I mean, these are not idiotic people. These are smart, great designers doing work that's getting published. I mean, they're very smart people, you know, but so I just take it back to the kind of the human nature that a lot of us have growing up. If for whatever reason, scarcity or just looking at things as always, this is going to cost me something. We kind of have a short-term view of things. We look at it that way. So we look at hiring someone, for instance, we're like, oh, I don't know if I'm going to hire. I don't know if I have enough money to hire someone. I'm like, but you know, if you need to hire someone, hire them. Your revenue is going to go up because you have another billable person on the team. And if your numbers work out, you just increase your revenue. You have more throughput. You're invoicing more now, more money to the bottom line.
Yeah. More management too, right?
if you hire someone inexperienced, it's yeah. more management. If you hire someone who's more independent, then
it's, right. But you know, that's a conversation for another time of my opinions about when we hire inexperienced people can expect them to be experienced without putting in the investment of making them experienced, yeah. helping them grow because we want them to grow. Because we want to grow, right? I mean, we want to create a succession plan, which most people don't really think about. They want to, I'm in it for what I can get out of it now. And we don't really, and especially a lot of sole proprietors or smaller firms don't think about the succession plan. And one of my best friends, he and I both were interns for a firm that was thinking about it, the succession plan. Well, both of those firm owners now have retired and he owns the firm, and it went from the 5-person firm that we used to work for to now it's somewhere around then hovering around 40, 50 people now. And it's just that growth that he decided to invest in his people. But I wanted to make a comment about when you were talking about like thinking about people as either investments or expenditures. And it goes back to Evan's comment about how we're taught in school as taught as like sole proprietors. We're taught like the hero architect, right? We can do everything. We can solve everything. And one of the interesting things was the experiment that has become a very successful experiment at Auburn, where I went, the Rural Studio. And the Rural Studio basically teaches students not just about community and being that citizen architect, but also teaches them the reality of the profession, that we are going to be work. Our success relies on our cooperation with other people, with the way that we work with other people, the team that we build around us, both the client, the contractor, the engineers, and all of that other stuff. And that's the fallacy that we need to move further and further away from. It. I don't mean to like divert the conversation, but you know, it's that teaching people that, you know, success in business really comes from success in the teamwork, in the team that we build.
This idea of investment versus expense is a huge deal. I think it's really interesting in a professional sense how much allergy there is with professionals like us to hire other professionals to augment our teams when we're the ones out there, the royal we of architects, are complaining that owners and builders don't want to use architects, right? It's like, it's doing the exact same thing that is being done to us, which is partially our fault as well, as far as communicating the value of architects and architecture with capital A, right? I think that is such an interesting psychological issue that kind of plagues our profession. How many people come to you, Enoch, who are interested in what you're doing, but ultimately are unwilling to invest in your systems and services to help them?
Oh, tons. I mean, by the time they usually get in conversations with us and actually reach out, they've kind of already decided to do that. But okay. when you look at the vast majority of people who come on our email list and just hang out and consume the free content and watch all the free YouTube yeah. videos forever and ever and ever, lots, a whole lot. I mean,
versus those who actually pull the trigger to
it's very rare. I wouldn't say it's rare, but it's a minority are the empowered architects who, because let's face it, I mean, even coming to a course or a program like ours where you're not quite sure what it involves, you're not sure the investment, you know, you see, again, if you see it as a cost, it's going to be scary. There's going to be some risk associated and you're like, heck, I'll just figure it out myself. What are they going to teach me to create a website? I'll do my own website on whatever.
You know? Of course you will.
Yeah. 5 years later. Right. But it is, you're right. It comes down, it's all about psychology. Evan, the more I learn about leadership principles, even all the great books that are coming out nowadays, you know, like Atomic Habits, like the books that we love to read by Chip and Dan Heath, and they talk about behavioral economics. And it's so funny because all what they're discovering is like human beings, we don't live our lives or make decisions rationally.
Mm-hmm.
And so,
right.
and so,
it's emotional.
Yeah, it's emotional. And you got to understand this. So one thing that a mentor once told me, and this may be helpful for your listeners, but he described this thing of the social mirror. And this is a thing in psychology where a lot of times, for instance, in sales, we will buy how we sell and we'll sell how we buy. So in other words, the way this impacts architects is a lot of times architects, when they go out to purchase their services, for instance, a marketing company, a business consultant like us or something, they're just looking at the bottom line. They're just thinking, what's mm-hmm. the cheapest? You know, I'm going to go do it myself. And then when they go out there to sell to their market, they're asking their market to trust them and value them as a professional. But there's a subconscious misalignment there. And so what happens yeah. is when their buyers, in other words, when their clients tell them that they're expensive or ask them to discount, et cetera, they have no sort of, I want to say moral ground, but maybe that's the wrong word for it. But they do it because that's what they do when they buy. So they understand it. It makes sense. They're like, oh, well, yeah, I talk everyone else down. So Cormac, if you're coming to me as a client and you're talking me down, well, I guess that's normal business as usual. I'll knock off $5,000 off the contract, and will this work for you?
Yeah. Do you know who Chris Doe is?
Have you I love Chris Doe's stuff. Yeah, he's great.
One of the things that he says on a recent talk was, "Don't ever." What was the word? It was like, if somebody ever asks you like how much you charge, you just tell them how much you charge, and when they try to get you to kind of break it down, you like that's you don't ever go beyond that. You don't share more details. And I always thought that was a really interesting strategy, right? It's like, this is how much it costs. And because to your point about like the negotiation process, and like, it's kind of like we're Craigslist, right? Where it's like somebody lists a price and then the natural response is to come back at, how many times have you got that email when you try to sell something on OfferUp or Craigslist, right? Mm. And it's like just a sliver of what you're asking. And it's like, how about this much? And it's like, how about no, right? Like we'll say that to that person. But if it's 80% of what we were asking, that's normal, right? And so then there's this kind of back and forth. And to your point, that creeps into how you perceive every single exchange that happens professionally then on. It creeps in. And Chris Doe is like, don't even go there. Like, don't, if it's not going to work, it's not going to work, and be okay with that. And I think, because I do think that there's this FOMO, right? Like, I do feel like I'm going to miss out. So I'm going to have to negotiate because I have to take every job.
And that is the problem right there. It's like, but where is my next meal coming from? Where is that next fee coming from? So, okay, Evan, you want me to do it for 50%. Well, you know, I know somebody else is going to do it. So why don't I go ahead and do it?
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
You know? Yeah. So, yeah. You know, we don't even, you know, it's as much the stance of drawing the line in the sand and saying no, but it's also making sure that we're valuing ourselves, valuing what we offer, what we bring to the table. We should know it. We should feel confident about it. But we're like, I'm not sure if I'm going to be able to like feed my kids for the next few months. So I'll go ahead and do that for half the price.
Yeah. 100%. And
go for it, Enoch. Sorry.
I was just going to say, one thing that can help people out with that is like, is just learning to sell and learning how to market and learning how to do business development. Like, this is the one thing, because if you're confident that you're a savage business developer, it doesn't mean you need to be extroverted. There are techniques that work for introverted people, which are a lot of architects, right? But like, if you know that, hey, hell or high water, I know how to go out and get work, then you can start to make decisions based upon that. But what I know is that a lot of architects, they don't even know that's a reality. They're like, hey, if the phone's not ringing, I have no idea what to do.
Yeah. The word that I couldn't think of that Christo used was justify. Don't ever justify.
That's
so
bad,
if you
bad
say
news,
this
yeah.
is the price, yeah, this is the price. Like, this is what it's going to take. This is the time it's going to take to do it. And because the justification, like, you actually start to doubt yourself when people come back to those too with the numbers that you're giving them. And it does go back to the confidence game. I think another thing that I've noticed, well, it's not something I think I've noticed. I've noticed this. I would witness this earlier today in a particular Facebook group. And there's this weird, I'll just say haters of really of certain architects out there. And I'll just say that they're successful architects. Like, there's this weird allergy to Starkitects, right? Which is like, so you may not agree with the projects that they do. You may not agree with the clients they take on or the work or the business practices of like how they treat their employees. I don't know. But there is just kind of this piling on effect that I've noticed when some Starkitect is putting their opinion out there about a certain topic. And you may not agree with that opinion, but then it becomes like, I actually, like, there's this weird thing about trying to tear them down. And I think that is so weird because do you think that's psychological too, I guess is my question, because we're on this perpetual flywheel of the struggle, right? Which is like the struggling artist thing that we all live in, as, you know, I'm generalizing here, but as architects.
Before you answer it, Enoch, there's this... I just watched, speaking of watching free videos, someone's talk on sellout architects.
Oh, okay. Was that the
you know
one
what I'm
I
talking
did?
About? Because it's you.
Yeah.
And it rolls into what Evan's talking about.
Yeah.
Because here's somebody who's successful, who is making money, who is maybe not anybody's cup of tea, and so you have the other side of the coin. Basically beating them down, saying, you know, like, what are you doing? You're ruining our profession. Whatever you're doing to it, it's not what architecture is.
Excellent. So just to summarize for, you can go look up that episode, but the idea behind, I think the title was Why Sellout Architects Are Saving the Profession. And the idea was, is that, all those business-minded architects that we love to point fingers at and say they're just design philistines and they do crap architecture, whatever kind of architecture they do, there's a part of the industry that wants to tear them down while they're the ones creating the jobs. They're the ones creating the stability. They're the ones creating economic
They're the
engine.
Ones out there creating architecture that people are looking at and talking about.
Yeah.
Like, exactly. They're actually the marketing department for the architectural profession on some level.
Well, I think the episode was a little bit more of what we... Evan have always talked about as kind of like the background architecture, kind of like, you know, it's just like, that's just, you know, some architect did that. It's kind of a thing that you would see on, they should have hired an architect Facebook page stuff. But it's, I kind of had this reaction when I was watching that episode about, and we can divert it back to some other thing, but this is my thing, is I always derail everything.
Derail away, Carmack.
is the fact is that the architects who are doing that, one of the things that was interesting about our trip to San Francisco during the AIA convention, which was the last time I actually saw you, it was the fact that we're walking around the Starkitects buildings and things, and you're just like, this or that. It's just like, you know, why did they do that? And we're thinking to ourselves,
I wouldn't have done it like that.
But then I've found myself in more recent, there's this interesting evolution as I get older and more experienced in my career of, it's like, I understand they probably didn't want to do that, but through the value engineering process, through the design by committee process, through all of this, they had to kind of sacrifice that. And when you were talking about the kind of the sellout architect, there's people out there who are just doing, let's just say, okay work. And it's not for lack of trying, and it's not for lack of desire to do something more. But the one thing that I do actually find very interesting about like the whole title of the Sellout Architect, Saving Architecture, is that is you're absolutely right. They are creating jobs. I listened to a lecture early in school where it was actually Robert Ivey who came in and he was talking about how little design architect, like the percentage of buildings that are built in the US, how little architects are actually involved. And so the more and more we can get involved with those projects, whether it's the small firm architect just going and doing like, you know, your local Pizza Hut or something like that, is better than the alternative of architects not being involved, right? Not being a part of that project. And so in by the way, for anybody who's listening, do listen to it. It wasn't like architect shaming or anything. It was just, it was really kind of just saying that everybody out there who's doing architecture is bringing value to the profession in one way, shape, or form. And I think that that's what we kind of sort of need to do is keep lifting up people. And sure, they're not going to get all of the prime stuff, but keeping architects is involved in the conversation is something that I think we need to do more of, obviously, right? And teaching them how to do business. What you do is teaching people who otherwise want to do this how to get out there and how to market, how to business develop, how to like actually do the things that bring the project into them is what we need more of. Because, like your journey started. It's interesting because as I was watching kind of like the splash video that Evan was talking about, your journey kind of like started in 2007, like is about the time my journey of being a self-employed architect was coming to an end because, you know, I didn't know the business of it. I didn't know how to like survive the tidal wave that was coming. And so I basically kind of reserved myself to, all right, well, I'm going to let somebody else figure out. I'll just continue to do good work. I'll let somebody else figure out how to get the work.
Yeah. Safe and easy thing to do. I was having a conversation earlier with some of the members of our program, and one of them's a very successful architect, does residential architecture, and one of his goals is to be everyone likes to set a vision, so he would like to get the AIA Firm of the Year, sort of like the North Star. This is like the firm vision, and they can do it. They're well poised to do it, right? But as we were listening, we're talking about the idea of awards, and we're talking about growth and everything, and we're kind of talking about how us as architects, going back to both of your points, we do like to always be critical of each other. So we've all been in those design, like in the AI meetings where that person's up there presenting their work and we're all clapping on the outside and saying, ooh, ah, but inside we're thinking like, oh, it's not that good, or I could probably do better than that. Like all of us are doing it.
Oh, I would have done it different.
Exactly. I know, because I did that too. You know, as a young student, I was looking at stuff. Oh, that's kind of cool, but oh, they sold out there. Why'd they do that? And it's just, so I like whenever I'm looking at a perceived flaw in someone else, I like to find that in myself. And I can see that in myself too. Like it's easy for me when someone else is succeeding sometimes in some areas where I'm jealous of them instantly, or I'm envious, or I want to try to belittle or minimize their success. So business for me is a soul growth. It's an opportunity for us to become our best people. And we have a measuring stick to be able to do it.
You talked earlier, I mean, there's an element of kind of imposter syndrome, or persona maybe is a better word, of kind of manifestation of an ideal state, right? You're a savage, you're gonna go out there, you're BD, you're a rainmaker, and you're gonna, and I'm wondering like what you see as kind of an aspirational version of, like thinking about this as like a manifestation technique, like what do you actually think the aspirational version of practice is? Because there's like the reality of it. I think we've been talking a lot about the challenges and the opportunities. What do you think is possible if we were firing on all cylinders?
Yeah, well, I think architects, they have a lot of passion for sustainability. They have a lot of passion for conscious construction. Like architects, we have these desires. We have these really good things that could make our world, let's face it, a better place. Mm-hmm. These things are not bad, but we lack the skill sets to be able to get that message and enroll other people in that message by and large. Now, there are certain people that do, but the more we increase our ability to be able to persuade someone, to be able to sell our value, basically, sell sustainability, to be able to sell good environments, good communities, it comes, like, this is a big load that we as architects got to carry. Like, whether we like it or not, whether you believe in God or universe or just God doesn't exist and we're just here. Let's face it, architects are like kind of given the mantle of creating our cities and our master plans and our communities. That's a big, big deal. And are we training ourselves enough to learn how to be speakers, to learn how to be people who can sell ideas, to cast vision, to stand for value? Because only the architecture, every single architectural piece that was ever created was the source of a vision. And here's the thing. Architects do have a reputation for overbuilding and overdesigning. But what I know is for certain is they wouldn't have that reputation if they had the ability to make it their client's idea to do that. In other words, you know what I'm saying?
Well, Enoch, this has been a really fantastic conversation. Thank you so much for hanging out with us today. And we look forward to talking with you more in the short term. This is going to be great.
Thank you for having me on here. Jeez, yeah. It's been like a reunion blast from the past. Thank you for having me on, allowing me to share about my journey, about what we're passionate about here. And again, thank you guys for for what you're doing here, just to spread information, continue the conversation.
And likewise, you too, man. Yeah. It's been fantastic.
All right. We're glad you're out there. Glad you're out there helping the architect who really wants to try.